Gregory Russo is a prisoner in Texas. If the state has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison staff is preparing to put Russo to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will broadcast live coverage of the killing in Texas, the state responsible for more than a third of all U.S. executions. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, legal analyst Larry Douglas and Mike Gillespie, Huntsville reporter outside the death house Pat Hartwells, Houston Vigil reporter Dave Atwood. The Execution Watch for Gregory Russo begins. Don't you know they're killing people? Don't you know they're killing people? Don't you know they're killing people? Don't you know they're killing people?
Good evening. This is Ray Hill. I am on Execution Watch tonight. We had hoped for a stay in Mr. Russo's case. Apparently that's not forthcoming. However, I have an interim report that the witnesses have not yet crossed the road in Huntsville, so I'm going to tell you a little bit about the case, which may be interrupted by our report from Pat in Huntsville. On May 30th, 2001, 75-year-old James Syverston was murdered at his garage in Tyler, Texas. He was in the business of repairing cars. The evidence presented at the trial established that he left home for work around 7 o'clock in the morning, had lunch in a cafeteria around 11 a.m., and spoke to a customer around 11:30 or 11:45 about repairing a car for her employer, Bob Bruner. Bruner dropped off his car at the garage at 12:30 p.m. When he arrived, the doors were locked, and there was a gray Chevrolet Corsica and a gray Audi both parked in the parking lot. Both cars belonged to Mr. Syverson. Mr. Syverson's wife went to the garage in the afternoon and saw Mr. Syverson's gray Corsica and gray Audi parked outside. She knocked on the door, but no one answered, so she went on about her business. According to credit card records introduced at trial, Ms. Syverson made a purchase at 5:38 p.m. Okay, is it time for Pat? Pat, are you there? Pat? Okay, he's not there. We don't have Pat yet. Later that night, around 7 p.m., they returned to the garage. When they arrived, the Corsica was gone, and the door to the office was unlocked. Ms. Syverson went inside and found her husband's body on the garage floor next to a white car, which appeared was working on at the time he was killed. His wallet he usually carried and the keys he usually kept clipped to his belt were missing, and one of his pant pockets was turned inside out. The police made the scene, took some evidence, but they left it up to Mr. Syverson's relative to look around and see if anything was out of place. And that turned up a hammer, which was out of place. And next to the hammer was a bottle or a jar. And so those were turned over to the police for examination. There were no fingerprints found on the hammer, which was later concluded to be the blunt instrument that was the cause of death. And Russo was charged with a murder, and his initial lawyers were Clifton Robertson and Brandon Bodd. The trial happened in Smith County, which is Tyler, Texas, and Mr. Rissard was convicted. We are short of our lawyer staff this evening. Jim is off on hospital excuse, and both Jack and Susan have legal responsibilities and cannot be here. But we certainly have Mike Gillespie, and we have Larry Douglas. Larry, what part of this was to be your part?
Well, I was to talk, Ray, I guess, about the ineffective assistance of counsel.
Well, hold on just a second. We got Pat. Pat?
Yes, I'm here.
What is happening?
Well, there was about five media witnesses and then five religious advisors went in, and I didn't see any of the family.
So Mr. Russo is going through this with his religious counselors and the media on his side of the gate up there, right?
Yes, his family was at visiting earlier, but I guess they both sides decided they shouldn't be witnessing tonight.
You've been watching this case for a while, Pat, haven't you?
A little bit, yes.
And you have any comment as we launch into the explaining what happened at the trial and on the appeals?
No, the only thing I say is even if a person is guilty, they don't need the death penalty. That's why we make prisons.
My understanding is that the visual in this case is kind of like the big guy on the Green Mile. We got this big old giant fella, and he makes an easy person for a jury in Tyler, Texas to convict.
Well, exactly, because we're talking about Tyler, Texas, Smith County.
Well, I understand we have some folks from out of the country that are hanging around.
We do. We have two ladies here from Australia, and one of them named Annie is going to give her view from Australia about the death penalty.
Put her on.
Hello, Annie speaking.
Annie, I love your accent. Go ahead and talk to us.
Well, I've come from Australia principally because I've been listening to Execution Watch on the internet, and I had this.
Uh-oh. We lost the signal. Annie from Australia is here, and she is here because of Execution Watch has brought her to the scene, and she wanted to see what this mess looked like up front. Do we have another call? Hello, David?
I'm here.
Okay, where is here?
I'm here at the corner of Benz and Main, right in front of St. Paul's United Methodist Church, and across from the museums.
And at 6 o'clock you have glorious light.
It's what?
You have glorious light. People can see you.
Oh, absolutely. A lot of cars going by. It's a very busy corner tonight because it's Thursday night, which is, you know, the night when the museum is open and free. So a lot of people walking, a lot of people driving by. Great visibility here. It's just wonderful. And I don't know how many hundreds go by when we're here.
How many vigilants have you?
We got seven, yeah. And we've got some new people, which is always good. And we're doing our thing out here with our signs and our banners, protesting the death penalty.
All right. Thank you, sir. We have word that the witnesses have crossed the road. This process has begun.
Okay. Well, you take care.
Thank you, David. David, how do we get in touch with your organization?
Best way is the website, which is tcadp.org. tcadp.org.
As in Texas Coalition Against the Death Penalty.org.
Right. Absolutely.
Thank you, sir.
All righty. You take care.
Okay, bye. Do we have Pat back? Annie?
Yes, I'm here.
I'm sorry. You got to watch these new phones in your ears.
Yeah, unfortunately.
It's gone again. I know what's happening. It happens to me on my telephone all the time. Okay, let me get Nomas. And so we're going to go back to Larry. Larry?
Yeah, Ray, before we get into that, though, I'd just like to talk a little bit more about the facts of the case.
Sure.
A couple of things. One, Russo's palm print. Mr. Syverson was working on a car inside the garage.
Yeah.
And Russo's palm print was found on the car under the hood where somebody would have been working. So that tied him to at least being inside
the car and in a place where other people might not have been.
Exactly. Russo was also arrested driving Mr. Syverson's car.
The Corsica.
Okay. He was driving the car, having the man's keys in the ignition, having the title documents in his pocket. So, Russo's position would have been that this is a circumstantial murder case.
Sure.
It's a capital murder. But Russo's one defense is that, okay, you have me on, robbery, but you haven't made murder because you can't prove that I killed him. That's a theory of defense in his case.
And in that regard, to make things even more confusing, apparently that Corsica sat there long after Mr. Syverson was killed.
It's an odd situation when you have the apparent killing occurring sometime around noon. And then the Corsica sitting there, and then later on after 7 o'clock or so, the Corsica's gone. And there's some evidence that Russo was seen at some point later on smoking crack cocaine.
Yeah.
He also got a ride to his mother's house, and other people saw the Corsica, and he said that's the Corsica's broken down, but he didn't want to go past the garage when they saw the police cars there.
Somebody wanted to go check that out, and he said not in this posse where I am.
And then the other concern is that although the murder scene was cleared right after the day that the May 30th, 31st date, the hammer and other items were not picked up until June 4th.
And the relatives picked those up and turned them in.
The son picked it up at the officer asked him to look around to see if any tools are missing, anything that seems out of place. And so when he calls the officer and let him know, you know, I found the hammer, and he showed him where it was, and the officer picked up the hammer, picks up a bottle next to the hammer. And for some reason, they start plucking hairs from Mr. Russo.
That would have happened in jail while he was in custody.
Okay,
right?
but the hammer and so forth were taken to the police property room. Then the same officer who placed him in the property room picked up all the evidence and carried it to the crime lab. The same officer carried to the crime lab.
And we don't know how he carried them. He may have carried them in one box.
We don't know how secure they were.
Yeah, sure.
But when they get to the crime lab, suddenly a criminalist at the crime lab finds that there are hairs on the bottle. Now, the nurse who plucked the hairs from Russo didn't keep track as to how many hairs she plucked. Or anything of that sort of where those hairs came from. So the issue that Russo raised was he raised the concern that, well, maybe this officer may have planted the hairs
intentionally or unintentionally
as a way of connecting me closer to the inside of the garage. Now, he was already placed inside the garage by the palm print.
Difference between the palm print, a la I'm robbing this guy of his wallet, and something closer to the murder weapon, as in the bottle and the hammer.
And that was exactly Russo's concern when he raised the issue of ineffective assistance of counsel. But the ineffective assistance of counsel under Strickland requires that the counsel his performance has to be substantially subpar.
Yeah.
And but for that subpar performance, the result would have been different. Saying that if he had done what's necessary to raise the issue of planted evidence, the officer planted the evidence, then Russo would have been found not guilty. Or a different result would have occurred. And that's a burden for him to try to reach. He couldn't get there. But as I mentioned to you earlier, in terms of the way the Texas death penalty statute and laws are constructed, the only thing that keeps an accused from death row is a fair trial. Okay, if the person can get a fair, if the judge doesn't do anything wrong, and the prosecutor doesn't do anything wrong, or the defense counsel doesn't do anything wrong, then there's a good chance that person's going to go to death row. And so, what the appellate lawyers and the writ lawyers do is look back over the case and see who did something wrong. And in this case, they were at least successful in getting the punishment overturned.
What was the basis of that?
the judge did something wrong by the courts determined that by the judge allowing his disciplinary record as part of his record to be introduced as
now,
punishment evidence.
Now, Mr. Russo had been to prison before, had a disciplinary record?
Yes. Okay, and that was the disciplinary record.
From his previous prison conviction.
Was according to the appellate court, improper to be introduced. So as a result of that having been introduced, they overturned the punishment, well, the death, and remanded it for a different punishment hearing.
This is Ray Hill, and I'm talking to Larry Douglas. Larry, is the rationale for not introducing previous prison disciplinary report, is the previous case didn't have anything to do with this case?
And Ray, I'm just not sure. Mike might want to say.
How does that work on that kind of evidence? And joining us is Mike Gillespie.
Well, it's relevant to bring up his future dangerousness. I think the problem is when that comes from a prison official without having the other side, just somebody making a notation in a report can be overly emphasized at a trial later on. This is not like there was a trial on him committing an assault and he had a lawyer and there was witnesses to show the total picture.
You're talking about a lack of due process within the prison system on the disciplinary.
One person who's an officer.
Well, half of our audience certainly understands the meaning of all that. Okay, Larry, what else in the trial that was interesting?
Well, the trial clearly was a circumstantial trial, circumstantially for the commission of a murder, which the murder was necessary for it to be a capital murder, murder in the course of committing
a robbery.
The appellate lawyers, their focus on the trial was to focus on the fact that in terms of trying to save him from the death penalty, saying somebody did something wrong. So their position was that the judge in his jury instructions to the jury, committed error by not, well, it listed lots of different points of error, but the more interesting ones I thought were the ones where the appellate lawyers claimed that the judge failed to define all of the terms that were contained in the charge. What is mitigation? They just went down the line point by point by point by point, saying these terms should have been defined. What does future dangerous mean? What does probability mean?
In other words, they were using a blanket. They were using a blanket. They questioned everything.
Which is what appellate lawyers
do.
Okay. So they weren't successful in all those things, other than...
Unless you find a pearl in that oyster. You're just talking about oyster shells.
And even the writ lawyers who raised the issue of ineffective assistance of counsel, claiming that the claim of planted evidence, the hair is being planted by the law enforcement, actually, trial counsel did a pretty good job. They started in an opening statement. They raised the issue of evidence being planted.
It certainly wasn't the trial lawyer's fault that was not.
The writ lawyers seemed to be focused on not the trial lawyer's failure to raise the issue. It was almost as though their lack of success in convincing the jury that he was not guilty because of their failure to convince the jury. I mean, it was couched differently, but when you look through and see what all the trial lawyers did in term, because everything you raise is a two-edged sword. So once they raise that issue of the officer perhaps planting evidence, that issue is raised, but then the DA comes right back and puts the officer back on the stand and just lets him tell the jury.
What is your reputation for truth and veracity in the department?
You've been in the department for this many years. Has anybody ever raised the issue of you planting any evidence? Have you ever been accused of planting evidence on anybody? Did you plant any evidence in this case? And once he refutes all of that, then there was no direct evidence that the defense could have shown to prove that the evidence was planted. Even raising the issue of the department and the crime lab's procedure in terms of protecting and sealing evidence, he raised all of those issues because the criminalist mentioned that, well, our procedures are such that if the officer gave it to us in a sealed envelope and came back and got it again and put something into it, there'd be no way of us proving that it happened. They pretty much admitted that the procedures were somewhat sloppy, but even if you can convince a jury that the police procedures in terms of protecting evidence may have been less than desirable, that does not, it's not particularly convincing that this officer planted evidence. The other thing is the hair follicles were used to identify when they got the hairs. The DNA that was consistent with Russo's DNA, and the trial counsel tried to show that by testing. Tried to say, well, were these hairs plucked or did they fall out? If they were plucked, then the follicles and the root would still be there. But if they just fell out, as they probably would have if hairs just fell, the follicle might not be there. Well, the prosecutor said, well, in the process of collecting DNA, we cut the tips off. So there's nothing here to...
In other words, you can't go re-examine this evidence.
And we weren't trying to destroy evidence or anything. Right. That's just a procedure.
Okay.
But counsel brought it all up.
Well, Pat raised the issue of Smith County, and I've had some issues with Smith County in another case, and would refer the listeners to go read the Kerry Max Cook stuff, because that was also Smith County. But this is 2001. As opposed to Kerry Max Cook was in the early 80s. One would hope that even a jurisdiction like Tyler, Texas, would improve.
In their procedures?
In their procedures. If they got caught, as they did in Kerry Max Cook, red-handed, they made that case up and stuck it on Kerry Max Cook. He was ultimately exonerated from it, but there's some difficulty in doing that. Let me shift over to Mike. And so, Mike, what you got?
I think the interesting issue why the appellate court did not look very clearly at the hair follicles, because even if the lawyers did not do their job properly, one thing that did come out that even when the state experts examined the hair, they called the defense lawyers and warned them that they would probably be cutting off the follicle part so they could not proceed to prove at later point the issue that we're talking about.
And did the defense lawyers accepted that?
They seemed to accept it at the time, and what makes me believe is that at the time they were not looking at that being an issue, because when the forensic people called up the defense lawyer and told them they were going to do it, nobody objected to it. So what I think that goes to show is that nobody was trying to be tricky. It's just the way it was. The other thing which I think is interesting is the way the appellate court looked at this, the defendant and his lawyers looked at this hair as being vital because the hair on the bottles is what put the defendant at the crime scene.
And connected him to the adjacent weapon.
That's correct. But when the appellate court looked at it, what they also said was that since we had a palm print on the underside of the car the mechanic was working on, since the mechanic kept his car keys on his belt, and when the defendant was arrested, he was not only driving the mechanic's car, but he had the car keys that was kept in the mechanic's belt that put him at the scene of the crime. The purpose of the hair argument was that he was not at the scene of the crime. So you have his palm print on the inside of a hood of a car, and you have the keys from the victim on his belt. There's no doubt that he was at the scene. So the second part of the Strickland test is not only that the standard of the lawyer fell below a standard, but also that the results would have been different if the lawyer was more competent. And what the courts held is that the issue was whether he was there or not, and there was plenty of evidence he was at the scene, so therefore the hair was not that important as it could be.
Okay, but as to robbery, basically Russo is admitting that part of it.
I didn't see him admitting robbery. I saw him admitting stealing a car.
Okay.
Okay, there's no...
Okay, but that didn't happen until hours after the...
Hours afterwards. And of course, the man was already deceased by that time, by 6 or 7 hours. And the question becomes, how did he get the keys? Did he go back inside the shop and he get the keys? I don't know. There's no indication in the brief whether
And the people who incidentally dropped by found the shop locked.
It was locked. No sign that anybody broke into it.
Yeah.
So the question becomes assumed that the key was taken from the victim at the time the victim was deceased. The car might have been picked up later on that night, but there's no evidence that the person who went back into the shop and took the keys off the dead body.
So this is confusing, and this is Ray Hill, and you've been listening to Mike Gillespie, and before that, Larry Douglas, and we are skeleton crew on Execution Watch tonight. Mr. Russo is in the chamber being killed even as we speak. I am haunted, really, Mike, and you were here the last time we did this show. They were executing Lester Bowers, and we had the same evidence or the same stuff in that case as we have in this case. We had a trial transcript. We had the appellate record. We had all of that, and we sat around this table, and we kind of agreed that certainly whatever was true that happened in Grayson County in Lester's case, what the DA said happened could not have happened.
We feel pretty strongly about that after looking over the facts of the case. The facts of that case that bothered all of us was the evidence showed that the victims were all assassinated with a
contact
wound of a barrel of a gun next to their head.
A .22 caliber, right. Which is used for that purpose.
Right. You've got four victims, two of which are police officers, and the concept of only one person put a barrel next to a man's head and fired a gun, and the other three men stood around and waited their turn.
Didn't make any sense.
The part that makes no sense from my viewpoint is how could something that obvious not be considered by the appellate court? It was not brought up at the trial level, but it just seemed
it took them 31 years to kill Lester. I mean, Lester Bowers was on death row for 31 years. He had seven execution dates. Now, this is Mr. Russo's first execution date, and he's only been there since 2001, which sounds like an awfully long time if you start doing the math. But for someone on death row, 14 years is not that long.
Well, the other interesting argument that was brought up in this case was the argument of counsels. As we know by reading this case, that the first trial was reversed because the judge allowed an evidence of his prior disciplinary records that should not have been admitted. So when it went up on the appeal level, the punishment level was reversed and it was retried for punishment. The trouble, according to the defendant, was that the judge appointed the same lawyers to represent him the second time around as the first time around. And his objection to that is that I've already filed that these lawyers were inadequate, that these lawyers did not do the job properly, and I do not think they should be representing me because they've got a conflict of interest because I already put them on notice. I think they're bad lawyers. And that's an argument that did not work with the court.
It did not work with the court. Well, if you're in Smith County, you're a district judge in Smith County, and you get a reverse and remand on the punishment phase. Larry, get ready to jump in here. And what are your choices? You either point the lawyers that have developed the case originally, or you point somebody that doesn't know a damn thing about it and have them start spending the court's money trying to learn about it. What's your choice here?
Well, what they did is they appointed the lawyers that are familiar with the case, and they discounted the defendants claim that these lawyers had a conflict of interest. What the appellate court said was that these lawyers might have had a conflict of interest, but that evidence was not developed to prove anything. That there can be a conflict, but unless there's some evidence that shows that that conflict affected the performance of the lawyers, they found there was no harm on the case.
Just saying you screwed up the first time is not sufficient to get them taken off the case.
Well, but it's more than that. They were found not to have screwed up because the lawyers did everything right.
The judge that had screwed up.
The judge screwed up on admitting that evidence, but nobody screwed up on the concept that it was not fully developed that the hairs were substituted. It was an argument that was made by defense counsel.
But that is not even the reason they diverse.
That was not the reason they reversed it. They reversed it because
of the judge admitted evidence should admit. And guess what judge that is? That is the same judge that is putting people, appointing the lawyers to write.
But there was
Am I wrong?
You're right, but there's no evidence these lawyers did anything besides doing their job and doing a good job at it. In fact, they had developed mitigating evidence where they had witnesses in court at the first hearing, family members, his fourth grade teacher, the mother of his child, to put on evidence to show that he does not deserve the death penalty. The defendant would not allow these witnesses to take the stand. He thought it was a waste of time. And at the second trial, at the same time, these lawyers had these witnesses ready, but the defendant...
Wait a minute. Let's go back to that, because that's a little bit... The defendant himself...
The defendant himself did not allow the witnesses to take
chose
the stand.
Chose to tell his... instruct his lawyers. And if you're the defendant, you can do that,
that's right.
I instruct your lawyers, do not put these people on the stand, because they're going to kill me anyway.
He thought he didn't want to put his family through the hardship, make them testify when he thought it was a waste of time, that it would not make any difference in the outcome. So the lawyers tried to save his life, and then when he came back in the conflict of interest, they tried to do the same thing again, and again, the defendant would not allow his fourth grade teacher, the mother of his child, to testify on his behalf.
Okay, this is the second round.
The second round.
Of the same thing. But they had been available for the first round.
For the first time and the second time. But again, with the conflict of interest claim that the second case was about, the court held that just because there can be a conflict of interest, that conflict has got to be proven. Just because there's a conflict, it doesn't mean that affected my performance. You've got to prove that not only is there a conflict, but the conflict affected my performance, and they couldn't do that. Because there was no harm done by what they did in the first trial. Again, the fact that he was there, it could be proved by other methods, negated whether or not that hairs was his on the bottle or not. The part that's interesting about the hairs to me is that the man was bald.
No, it was chest hair.
But he was bald.
Yeah.
You mean if he had the hair is falling out?
Yeah.
Yeah.
If they couldn't come off his head, and if he was on his chest, he had a shirt on, I question where the hair came from.
Well, that's certainly a question that is now too late to ask, because he's strapped to a gurney getting juices.
And I also wonder, and I do not understand this, but I do not understand how the state can go ahead. And I understand they need to take some of the follicles off to prove DNA, but they need to take the follicles off every hair sample to prove DNA?
And to announce that they're going to do that?
Well, actually, they didn't announce that they did it. They didn't let the defense lawyers know. The defense lawyers testified when they did the affidavits for the writ that the DA informed them after the fact that the roots had been cut off and completely consumed in the DNA analysis process.
Well, now,
so both lawyers testified to that.
You see, now, if you've got a chunk of body deteriorating in the witness box, that's going to raise a stink, and there may be a rationale for getting it out and disposing of it. But if you've got hair follicles, that's not going to have a major impact on the atmosphere where you breathe.
And the lawyers mentioned, brought up these issues. They tried to raise the issues, but every time you raise them, you get slapped down with the officer coming forward and testifying, the jury likely believing him. Because what you're suggesting is that this officer planted evidence.
Sure.
And that the DA then covered the evidence planting by clipping off the roots in the process of doing DNA analysis, thus not allowing that evidence to be available to the defense, and that the procedures were such that there's no accounting as to how many hairs there were plucked to begin with. So were these plucked hairs? Were they hairs that fell out?
Well,
were they additional hairs? What were they?
See, I in my list, I'm a greenhorn layperson out here, and listening to this evidence, I did not immediately jump to the conclusion that the hair follicles were planted intentionally. I went to the conclusion that if you got the evidence box, and you got a hammer in there, and you got a bottle in there, and then somebody goes and collects some hairs, and they may be loose in there, that the cross-contamination between the evidence in the evidence box may have been incidental rather than intentional. See what I mean?
Exactly. Yeah, I understand it.
And since he was bald, then the hairs that you found on the bottle had to come from the body, and then Mike raises the question, well, did he go in there bare-breasted to commit a homicide? That don't seem likely.
Or if they fell off his arm or something else.
Yeah, right. But a hair follicle is a hair follicle. Then the destruction of the follicles seems real weird because I don't know what is the necessity for doing that.
I don't understand the necessity of destroying all of the hairs. You only need to destroy one or two to get a DNA sample. Why do you need to take the follicles off every piece of hair you have?
And if you find hairs on the bottle and you have plucked hairs from elsewhere, how do you sort out when the hair actually left the body? There's a bunch of questions here. And you know, you say, well, you're raising obtuse issues. But the fact of the matter is we're talking about somebody scheduled to be killed here. As a matter of fact, we're talking about somebody who is being killed even as we speak.
But the next question is, since the hair they plucked off the chest they know came from him, why do they have to do DNA on that hair? It seemed like you'd have to do DNA on the hair found on the bottle. But there's no allegation there was any follicle material on that hair. So again, I question, why would a DNA be done? I could see the hair on the bottle to prove it came from him, but the hair they took off his chest,
they knew it came from him.
They knew it came from him. So yeah, why do they need to destroy that to prove DNA?
Yeah, see, these kind of questions, which takes me back to Smith County. It's a strange place.
But I think the bigger issue is this, what the appellate court said, that the whole issue for the hair is really not an issue of where the hair came from. It's an issue of proof that he was at the scene. And there was plenty of other evidence that he was at the scene. That therefore what happened to the hair could not prove innocence in this case because they had lots of evidence he was at the scene of the body.
Sure.
So therefore that's why that was not looked at as more closely as it should have been.
But Larry brought up the interest that the murder case evidence is what you call circumstantial. The evidence toward a robbery is more substantial than circumstantial, would you say?
He
had the car keys. It's an indication of a robbery.
As Mike mentioned, though, it's a clear theft case. It's more of a clear theft case. Not necessarily even a robbery. I mean, he could have stolen the car.
Yeah.
Okay, that's pretty clear.
Yeah.
But did he? Property. Rather, did he do anything to this man?
Hearst got convicted for mutilating the body, not creating the body to be mutilated.
Okay.
And that was in Galveston County. That's a different jurisdiction.
And of course, the other question that nobody's brought up is what was he robbing and stealing? I mean, obviously he was doing drugs.
Well, the Corsica for one thing.
But the Corsica he took after
and there is
at the end
wallet.
Of the night. At missing wallet.
Yeah.
The pocket turned inside out, committing a robbery on a person.
But that is a mechanic's shop full of valuable tools, full of cash probably in the cash drawer. You'd think that if this was some kind of theft or robbery looking for drugs, that there'd be something missing, something pawned, something gone through to look for money. But my question is, there's no evidence as to why this man was killed. It wasn't to steal his car, because the car wasn't sold until that night. The man was killed, but for what reason? why did he kill him?
Yeah, I mean, most of these trials leave questions not answered. I mean, either one of you ever practice a case where, you know, when you get through with it, you say, wait a minute, these questions were not answered by either me or the opposition.
Well, sometimes when you know your client, you can figure out the motivation from,
yeah,
talking to them.
You would know your client, right.
And prosecutors are notorious for saying, you know, we don't have to prove motive. We just prove that it happened. So why he did it, we don't have to prove that. The fact is we can just prove that he, on or about such and such a day, did such a thing.
Right.
And that's
not in the chart. Motive is not in the chart.
Never.
And so you don't have to prove motive. You only have to prove the elements of the charge.
Exactly. And proof, as I try to explain to people, is can you convince a jury that it happened?
Yeah.
It's not like the proof of having mathematics. It's a convincing a jury that it happened. If enough people believe you, if enough of the jurors believe you, then it's been proven.
Well, that's the practice of law.
Yeah.
And everybody's still practicing. They're going to get it right someday.
It just seems that when you're going to take the drastic punishment of putting a man to death, you need more evidence of a violent crime, more evidence of somebody that's a future danger to society, more evidence of somebody that somebody is dangerous. What you have here is the murder of a mechanic for no apparent reason and picking up his car later on that night. None of this shows me future dangerousness. Now, they talk about in his background, there was some evidence of future dangerousness, but that wasn't developed well in our briefs.
And the other thing about future danger, though, again, this is the way this statute and the laws are interpreted. You can actually use the offense that he just got convicted of.
Well, they do that frequently, the handyman case.
Future danger. So he killed he just found him guilty of killing a 75-year-old man, bludgeoning him with a hammer. Yeah,
and the ideal case in that is the Candyman case,
yeah,
which Jim talks about, where the Halloween go out and pick up cyanide-laced candy to kill his own children for the insurance money. And that's the only thing he ever did.
Yeah, but that's so horrible that it gives chills to people to think that somebody would do something like that. This is a situation where, for all we know, it could have been an argument between the two men over a bill. And during the argument, something happened.
I mean, you can come up with other explanations for the homicide in this case. Now, having the Corsica keys is another matter.
But he came back and picked up that keys 6 hours later.
6 hours
and
later.
And that's the part that makes no sense. When later on he didn't want to drive past the building because there were police there, he didn't want to be seen around the building, yet he came back to the scene of the crime and picked the car up?
Well, the other thing is that the guy they're killing right now. By the way, have we got word from Huntsville? We have no. Could you call her and find out what the deal is? Oh, she did, and the witnesses have not come out. I'd like to point out that it's 6:43. The witnesses have been in there an awfully long time. Normally. And I live in horror that Texas is going to do an Oklahoma or Arizona and leave somebody on that gurney being tortured over a long period of time to death, because we have no idea where these drugs come from. We have no idea what compounding pharmacies putting them together. We have no idea what is in them. And the state of Texas and its governor and the legislature has decided to keep all of this a big secret from everybody else and not available to defense lawyers whose clients are being killed with these drugs, because they are so afraid somebody's going to question their absolute ability to kill anybody under any circumstances that they choose. And so that is something to be fretful over, is the fact that we have not heard from Huntsville that this process is over. And if we go off the air in another 15 minutes and we have no word from Huntsville, heaven knows this will be in headlines on every newspaper on the planet tomorrow, that Texas did another inadequate execution job because of the use of phony medications to kill people with.
And I want to comment on the defendant's claim against his counsels that they were inadequate, they were inefficient. There's not many times in life that somebody can be called inefficient and given another chance to prove they're not, except in a case like this. The first trial, he claimed they were inefficient. Then it was retried.
Only the punishment part of it
was retried. Yeah. But now the lawyers have a chance to prove they're not inefficient, to prove they're efficient, to prove they want to do a good job. It's not often in life people who make mistakes are given an opportunity to fix it again. I wonder if the claim of conflict of interest, inefficiency, can turn the tails and make a lawyer do an excellent job because he's now being called on the carpet. The other part of it, which I find is interesting, is that by all accounts, this man did not let them do their job. They were
he interfered
with them doing their job.
Larry, what do you think about that?
Well, particularly on the punishment side, that he effectively prevented them from
putting on
the witnesses that they had prepared to try to save his life. You know, his concern that he didn't want to put his family through this, or that it was not really going to be effective to begin with. Why he did that just makes no sense.
Or why he did it twice.
Yeah.
So, the other thing that bothers me about this kind of case is you're talking about somebody who's strung out on apparently crack cocaine because he was observed by witnesses later that night smoking crack and getting high on that. That person, by the time they get around to getting executed, has been without crack for a long time. So they're not even killing the same person that did the crime. Maybe the same fingerprints and the same identification, the same name, same mother, same ancestry. But the person that's actually being executed is not the person that committed the crime. And that's always been something that haunted me. And then there's something else about this case that is especially haunting, and that is that it is a Smith County, Tyler, Texas case. I went up to Tyler, Texas one time to lead a demonstration after a gay bash killing in Tyler, Texas, in Smith County. And we had it in a downtown park. And in the course of our having a demonstration, we had Senator Rodney Ellis, and we had a bunch of Deborah Denberg, and we had a bunch of senators and state representatives from around the state come up and join us in that demonstration. The young man had been brutally killed. By the way, at his request, the people that killed him were not given capital murder, but given straight murder. And so we were up there holding a demonstration, and there was an older woman and her attendant walked out of a house that faced the park and came over to join our demonstration, and she had numbers tattooed on her arm. She was a survivor of the Holocaust. And you don't walk out of Tyler, Texas without that making an enduring impression on you. Then she questioned whether or not the police were adequately going to investigate that case in Tyler, Texas. They did, and they found the assailants, and they brought them to trial, and they were punished according to the requirements of the law. So I worry about places like Tyler, Texas. Well, gentlemen, is there anything we have overlooked in this case?
On the same topic, I have been very clear that I do not think that hair evidence was relevant because there was lots of other proof that he was on the scene. But let's talk about what is relevant. What is relevant to me is the procedure they use in gathering this hair. When they don't count the amount of hairs being taken out, when they don't initial the evidence envelope, when they put in the evidence box, they don't seal the bottle separately from that. I question the procedures the police use in this case. And even though the appellate court might say, well, we know he was there because of a palm print, if you're going to execute somebody, you need to make sure all your procedures are proper. And there comes a time that when the procedures are not proper, a man should not be executed because procedure is not proper. I don't think it's relevant whether or not it's his hair from his head or it's his hair that fell out. What's more relevant to me is how could they not initial the envelope that the hair was put into, how they could not account for all the hairs that were taken out. That's a sloppy procedure for gathering evidence.
And to add that, Mike, that the procedure for the DA having taken his expert and cut out the roots off the hairs in their DNA analysis, they didn't have to do that.
Again, for something like a death penalty case, all the rules should be followed strictly. If you're going to have the most extreme
if you're going to take somebody's liberty away, I think all the rules should be followed strictly. But taking their life is a magnitude higher than
right.
that.
They're easy to say in the appellate court that the inefficiency of counsel is a claim, but it cannot be proven, so we're going to overlook it. But the procedure should not be overlooked because there's got to be some punishment on a case like this when a man is executed. They need to make sure that everything is done properly, make sure it's a good execution. And from gathering this hair, they open up an area for the lawyers to go to that the lawyers could not make much proof of, but to me it shows there was flaws with this case.
I need to inform the audience that we have word from Pat in Huntsville that there has been no exit from the chamber by the witnesses, and there is 9 minutes left in this hour, or 8 minutes left in this hour, and this is highly unusual. This process of execution is taking an inordinately long period of time. Let me explain how this works. If someone is about to be executed, they are brought into the chamber. That is, the case is cleared. There's no pending appeals. All the courts have signed off on it. The execution is going to happen. The person scheduled to be executed is brought into the chamber, strapped into the gurney, and the needles are placed in their veins by something less than professional medical personnel. And then that get the witnesses, then, after all that's happened, cross the road to go in and observe the execution. Once the witnesses are in the room, they ask the person being executed for their last statement. They have a time limit on that. If that starts to be a filibuster, they cut that off. And then they make that statement, and then they begin to induce the killing drugs into the body. As soon as the body is pronounced dead, and they do that by listening to the breathing and checking the pulse. And when that happens, then the witnesses are excused and they leave the building. That's why we know for sure. Oh, Pat's here. Put Pat on. Okay, Pat? Okay. We're calling Pat. And so the deal is that they don't tarry with this process because the contractor who picks up the body is scheduled to go over and pick up the body and carry it to a chapel nearby so the family can touch the body while it is still warm. Pat, what you got?
Hello?
Yes, Pat.
Yes, the witnesses just came out.
The witnesses just came out. It is, we've only got 6 minutes left in this hour. That is an inordinately long time for a process to take place, isn't it?
I would think so. So we can either say that something went wrong in there, or perhaps they're trying to be chintzy on the drugs.
And we will hear the whole story from Mike Grazik in the morning or later on tonight in the Chronicle.
He's already out writing it right now so he can get home for supper.
I appreciate your coverage of the story, Pat. I'm sorry we couldn't get Ann on, but her ear kept hitting the phone in the wrong corner.
I'm sorry. Yeah, they came from Australia to, they hear us in Australia on Execution Watch and the prison show. So this shows the importance of staying on the internet and telling people.
And by the way, I haven't complimented you on the work that you're doing on the prison show, but I'm glad you're over there bringing those people up to speed on this issue.
Thank you very much.
Okay, good night, sister.
We will see you July the 16th, isn't it?
Well, we hope not, but that's when
we hope not. Clifton Williams.
Thank you.
See you then. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And that was Pat from Huntsville, and she... here comes the music. Mercy. Well, Gregory Russo is dead. He was killed by the state of Texas over the last hour. My name is Ray Hill. I am the host of Execution Watch. Tonight we had Larry Douglas and Michael Gillespie. Congratulations on both of you doing a very fine job of raising the questions that we all need to think about in this case. Our reporter from Huntsville, Pat Hartwell, just brought us the bad news that the process is over. Dave Atwood, with a demonstration in Houston, brought us news from that. The next scheduled execution is Clifton Williams. It is on July the 16th. We hope that he gets a stay, and we do not have to do that. Our executive producer is Elizabeth Stein. Our technical director is Otis McClay. Who's on the board tonight?
Jacob Santillan.
Jacob is our board operator tonight. Our videographer, when we have video, is Mark Pertle, and our theme music is written by Victoria Panetti, and you're listening to that right now, so as my voice fades, Victoria's got good control over you. I hope we don't ever have to do this show again. My name is Ray Hill, and good night.